Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another episode where today, inshallah, we're going to be discussing the fine-tuning argument for God's existence. Now, this argument, although all kinds of teleological arguments had been made before, and teleological arguments sometimes can refer to, most of the times will refer to things with purpose, but always will be linked to some kind of a design. In this case, this fine-tuning is a very specific type of teleological argument, which in particular deals with the issue of life-permitting universes, or LPUs, life-permitting universes. And I'm going to go through, inshallah, today, some of the most prominent ways that this argument is being made, both in apologetics circles and or the philosophy of religion. And then we're going to discuss some of the strengths and limitations of this argument, some of the objections to this argument, and how I prefer to use it. I mean, we've already spoken about the contingency argument, and in many ways the contingency argument I see as the asal, as the foundation for all arguments, in terms of demonstrative proof. Not just the contingency argument, but the question, the Quranic question, which is, أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ هُمُ الْخَالِقُونَ, were they created from nothing, or were they themselves the creators of themselves? This proposition of the fact that there cannot be something which is self-generating or self-maintaining is the basis for all arguments for God's existence. And we talked about before the very important but very basic question where we all start from, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? A very difficult question for atheists to deal with. But that's the basis. This is something which can be used sometimes as a supporting argument. So these are the kind of points that you could talk about in terms of the fine-tuning, or that are being spoken about in terms of the fine-tuning argument. Number one, that initial conditions of the universe must be adjusted just right in order for life to exist. Now, this is called the life-permitting range. The fine-tuning argument, let's talk about what it's not. It's not saying that the universe is beautiful and aesthetically pleasing and therefore it must have a creator. It's not saying that the universe is designed so immaculate and it's so complicated and therefore it must have a creator. These are not what the fine-tuning arguments of today are stating. The fine-tuning arguments of today are stating that the universe is constructed in a way which allows life to exist. Human life? No, it could be any life. So there is a life-permitting range. And this is an incontrovertible and indubitable fact. And nobody has actually denied that. The fact that there is life. The fact that there is life in the universe. I mean, who can deny that? Yeah. And the secondary fact, which is that the universe therefore allows life to exist within it. It's, you can have habitable life in the universe. These are two clear, straightforward facts. Okay. Now, how this argument is usually made is that they say, well, you've got these constants. You have these different constants, or you have these fundamental constants, and they could be 6, 9, depending on what you decide to count and what you decide not to count, which, if they were any different by the smallest of margins, by the breadth of a, you know, hair-splitting difference, then the universe wouldn't exist as we know it, and or would not allow life to exist within it. That's a very straightforward argument, isn't it? And I think this is why this is the potency of the argument. Almost anyone can understand it. You know, let me tell you one more time before we get into this. This is not William Paley's watchmaker's argument. This is not William Paley's watchmaker's argument, which Richard Dawkins spent so much time trying to refute. Because William Paley's watchmaker argument in natural theology was that, you know, you're walking around, you see a watch, you know, and he referred to it as contrivance. Actually, the word contrivance now usually is used pejoratively. You know, if you contrive something, it's as if you're trying to superimpose some kind of a narrative on something pre-existing. But in his terminology, when he wrote this book, Natural Theology, whenever it was he wrote it, he meant that it's got exhibiting factors which indicate that it's been carved into being. Not like a rock. So he compares a rock to a watch. So when you're walking in the, you know, forest or whatever it is, desert or forest or whatever example you like, you see a rock and you see a watch, you know that the rock has different qualities to the watch, because the watch has contrivance. This contrivance, this it's seeming constructions which are superimposed, or not superimposed, that they are carved into being by some higher intelligence. And the inference, therefore, that is made is that it was. That there was a designer, there was a watchmaker. Richard Dawkins, and probably the only argument he actually spends time trying to deal with. Because if you look at his books, The God Delusion, hundreds of pages, The God Delusion, but he only spends 5 pages on the cosmological argument. I don't know if this is something you knew or not, but he spends five pages on the cosmological argument, and 2 pages, I think, to the ontological argument, something like that. The rest of it is just some kind of run about religion and what it does, you know, a moral run, even though, as we mentioned before, he doesn't have anything to base morality on, according to himself. But he does spend some time in his other books, especially The Blind Watchmaker, talking about this argument, which is William Paley's argument. He does spend some time talking about it. And basically he says, because of the theory of Darwinian evolution, and this is the argument he made with John Lennox in the debate that he had, series of debates that he had with him, he says, because of the theories of Darwinian evolution, we don't need, he says, we do not need a God to explain design, because he states that design is understood through the Darwinian mechanism. And so any reference to God is superfluous. It's not a required reference. It's John Lennox, just to give you, to kind of spoil the story for you if you haven't already seen this, and he answers this very well, to his credit. He states, look, Richard Dawkins is doing is confusing mechanism and agency. Mechanism is how something is being done. So even if we agree, he states, that there is such a thing as Darwinian evolution, that's the mechanism through which life comes into being. But agency is, well, through what will? Was it a guided or unguided process? And he's saying that just because there's a mechanism of something happening, it doesn't mean there's no agency behind it. Like, for example, a train. This is my example now. A train can move from one station to another. But it doesn't mean, because we can explain the mechanics of the train, or a car can move, like I got here by driving. I can explain to you mechanically and scientifically how the car moved when I came here. And that would be the equivalent, in this analogy, of Darwinian evolution. This is how it happens, if we accept all the premises, for the sake of argument. But it doesn't explain how the car came from this place to that place with blindly. And usually, this is exactly the wording he used, blind watchmaker, meaning it's an unguided process. The theist is saying, no, it's a guided process. It has to be a guided process. Like when I came here, the best way to explain how I got from home to here is through me driving it. I'm the agency. I'm the driver. So the reason why I put this to you, because some people sometimes get confused between this type of teleological argument, which is most famous in Western circles, through William Paley, and the fine-tuning argument. They're not the same thing, although there is clearly a flesh that joins the two types of argument, which is the idea of design. The fine-tuning argument, just to repeat, is an argument that states explicitly, it's an argument that states explicitly that the universe couldn't have been, by virtue of probability, okay? And I'll tell you what they mean by probability. We'll go into more depth. It couldn't have been made in a way, or it could not be in such a way, that would be life-permitting, okay, had there not been a designer. And the probability of that not being the case is infinitesimally small. And they'll give you numbers. They'll literally give you numbers. And how can they give you numbers? They'll give you numbers based on the constants. So the most popular one that they use is the electromagnetic constant. The gravitational constant is probably the second most popular. But the electromagnetic constant is the one that's probably the most popular one that they use. And you can see here on the slide, because if it was larger than zero, the universe would accelerate at a stage, okay, which would make life not permitted, it would be non-life permitting. And if it were to decelerate, the opposite would happen, and also the life permitting range would be obscured or otherwise inhibited. or negated even. Yeah? And so, this is an example, the electromagnetic constant. And so, the way Craig makes this argument in both his works, his actual written works, and also his publications, apologetic publications, is that he states there's three options. You've got these constants, and you have three options. Either it was from necessity, either it was from, chance, necessity, or design. These are your three options. And he says that the chance or the possibility that this could have been from chance, I'm talking about William Lane Craig, by the way, when I said Craig, just in case anyone who doesn't know who I'm talking about. He says the possibility that it was from chance is, and he'll give you some numbers, this amount, which is infinitesimally small. And it couldn't have been by necessity because there's nothing necessary about the laws of nature. And therefore, it must have been by virtue of elimination, design. This is the... But I don't agree with the way that this argument is being made. And when I was younger, some years ago, I used to like this argument. But now, when I thought about it a bit more deeply, I think this argument is actually flawed. And we can make a stronger argument than this. And I'll tell you why. First and foremost, yes, necessity, I agree with the sentiment that there's nothing necessary about the laws of nature. True. But does necessity, and I spoke to be fair, Alistair McGrath, actually, when I was in the University of Oxford, I spoke to him about this directly and had the conversation with him about this. And I said, and this actually came from Firas Zahabi. I was mentioning him today in other contexts. But he gave me this idea when I had a conversation with him, because he's got a background in philosophy as well. And he brought this up to me, and I thought, this is actually very clever what he's saying. And then I brought the attention of Alistair McGrath, and he agreed with me on this. Necessity does not threaten the theistic conclusion. If we say that the laws of nature are necessarily that way, so what? Because we've already explained, okay, that so long as it's not necessity in the category of existence, then we're not enumerating the necessary existences. We're just saying it's a necessary fact. So what if it's a necessary fact that the laws of nature are in XYZ way? So what? It doesn't do anything. It does nothing to threaten the theistic conclusion. So there's no contradiction. So in a sense, it's a false. I'm not sure if this is a word, but trichotomy. I don't know if someone can research if this is a word. But it's a false kind of separation here. Okay, because you can't. It's not either or. It can be, we are saying, design and necessity. Those two things shouldn't be, there's no necessary separation between those two things. So at first I thought, yeah, Craig is onto something, but now that I think about it, I think Craig is wrong for separating them like this. And moreover, I think Craig is wrong again. In so much as he talks about chance. Now, what is chance? And I've had conversations with people about this. And once again, Firas Zahabi does a good job. In my discussions with him, that, you know, very casual, informative discussions in the car and whatever, he makes a really good point. What is randomness? What is this chance that we're talking about? And he argues, and he should have this written somewhere, because he makes a really good point. You know, he argues that actually chance is just something which we don't understand. It's chance is an expression. When we say randomness or chance and these things, well, he talks about randomness. Let's be clear, right? He talks about randomness. If someone says it's random, the word random has specific connotations. Random, something which is random, is just you're talking about something which you can't explain. It's just an expression of your own ignorance. If you knew the prior conditions, you'd understand the workings out. But because you don't know the prior conditions, you don't know the workings out. Chance is a little bit different. We're going to talk about what chance is probabilistically and what they mean by chance and how, to be fair, I don't accept what they mean either. When I say they, I'm talking about the philosophers of religion. So is there and can there be a universe from chance? I say that's impossible. I don't think that's an option. And I'm going to argue that in what follows. But before we get to that, I'm going to tell you what they mean by chance, because it's a bit of an elaborative discussion. Okay. So you can say, you could say, one can say that it's from chance. but it's not an actual option. It's impossible for it. I'm saying it's absurd for it to be from chance. I'm saying that necessity and design should not be separated. That's what I'm saying. And therefore, the conclusion is only that there had to be something which put a lawmaker that put the laws into place. There's only one conclusion. This is because when we say there's three conclusions, it's like, okay, you can choose now, whatever you like. In probably one of the first videos I've ever done on YouTube, the first one that got viral is a conversation I had with a guy in the speaker's corner. And I told him, what's the chances of me grabbing a, you know, I was like 24 at this time, you know, and I was affected by this stuff. What's the chance of me putting, you know, letters into a bag and shaking it up and throwing it onto the floor and it becoming like Macbeth? And he stated, it's very low, I agree, but XYZ, still possibility, given an infinite multiverse, whatever it may be, yeah? And across the years when I've been thinking about this, I say that, and we're going to come to this, there's no chance of it happening. And we're going to come to why I say that. There's no such thing as chance like that. And especially considering you can't even explain why this bag of letters came there in the first place in the case of our universe. You can't explain how the universe came there in the first place. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there such a bag of letters? You see? So there's no chance. And this is a very strong conclusion, but it's hopefully going to be justified. But before we get there, I want to talk about how they present this argument in the philosophy of religion. So one of the key proponents of this type of argument is a guy called Robin Collins. And he says, the core fine-tuning argument relies on a standard principle of confirmation theory, the so-called likelihood principle. This principle can be stated as follows. Let H1 and H2 be two competing hypotheses. According to the likelihood principle, an observation E counts as evidence in favor of hypothesis 1 over hypothesis 2 if the observation is more probable under H1 than H2. You can see why this kind of groundwork is going to be required in order to then say, well, this possibility that has come from design or this possibility that has come from chance. But what I'm saying is H1 and H2 are not actual options. And we'll come to that, yeah? So he gives an example. To illustrate the need for the restricted version, suppose that I roll a die 20 times and it comes up some apparently random sequence of numbers, and he gives a long list of numbers, yeah? The probability of it coming up in this sequence is 1 in 3.6 times 10^15, yeah? Or about 1 in a million billion. To explain this occurrence, suppose I invented the hypothesis that there is a demon whose favorite number is just the aforementioned sequence of numbers. And this demon had a strong desire for that sequence to turn up when I rolled the die. Now, if this demon hypothesis were true, then the fact that the die came up in this sequence would be expected. That is, the sequence would not be epistemically improbable. Consequently, by the standard likelihood principle, the occurrence of this sequence would strongly confirm the demon hypothesis over the chance hypothesis. You see, the chance hypothesis, which we don't believe is a plausible one in the first place. But this seems counterintuitive. Given a sort of common sense notion of confirmation, it does not seem that the demon hypothesis is confirmed. And so here, these are the three types of evidences they use, okay? When they're talking about the chance hypothesis versus the God hypothesis, if you like, these are the kind of things they use, the fine-tuning of the laws of nature, the constants of nature, and the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. Now, when he talks about probability, probability is a mathematical concept, but be careful because there's different kinds of probability. So especially in fine-tuning, when they say probability, and I don't know if I told you this story before, but when I first got into this, like, what, 6-7 years ago, I had a conversation with a mathematician. Did I say about this? Okay, I'll tell you, this is a story. I had a conversation with him. He was a professor in one of the German Central European universities, yeah? And it was a private discussion, thank God, you know. And he saw the video that I told you about with with the guy, and I was talking about the probability of the universe coming from chance or randomness or whatever, is this number, which was like a very low number, yeah? And he said, what kind of probability are you using? He goes, because if you use Bayes theory, and he sent me this kind of long list of, he got these constants, he put them in a, you know, thing. And he said, what do you think? I said, I looked at it, I don't know what he's talking about. But I don't want, because he was being a bit arrogant. So I didn't want to concede. I didn't want to say anything. So I just looked at him, I said, let me think about this for a second. But before I continue, I looked at him in the face, I said, are you sure you got those numbers correct? He said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. And he had a smug, you know, he's this guy's a professor in mathematics. And what am I? I haven't done anything in mathematics to the level that he has. Okay. He said, okay. I said, I tell you what, Professor, I think you should double check your numbers. You've written a couple of things here which I need to process properly, but I don't think, just double check your numbers and we'll talk about this later. Okay? And I went and spoke to some mathematicians or some people that were good at maths, and I showed them, I said, what's this, man? So this is Bayes theory, and he, you know, showed me this is how it works, and this is, and it was long, man, and, you know, I haven't covered Bayes theory like this before, yeah? And he explained, he made a mistake, the guy. I said, are you sure this is a mistake? Because I went to some brother, actually a Somali guy, you know? And he said, yeah, he made a mistake here. I said, are you sure? He said, yeah. So I went back to him and said, so did you check your numbers? He said, this is what you wrote and this is how it should be. You know, and he said, I said, that's right. I said, next time you have to be sure. And then I just dragged it into a philosophical discussion. But from this I learned that when you're talking about the fine-tuning, you've got to be very specific. And moreover, not only do you have to be very specific, you have to understand the different types of probability. So in the philosophy of religion, usually the way that these guys make the argument, like when I say these guys, I'm talking about Swinburne, for example. Richard Swinburne makes this argument like this. Craig, to a lesser extent, this guy, what's his name, Colin Robbins, they use what is referred to as epistemic probability. And epistemic probability is divided into two different types. There's a subjective type, which I think we've discussed before in this class, which is the idea that you know your standards. You already know, like, this is probably going to happen, this is not going to happen. And most reject this type of probability as a way of trying to assert the truth of a designer, for example. So they're left with what you call logical epistemic probability, referred to by Swinburne, by the way, as inductive probability. And I tried to look for different definitions of it. And Plantinga had this very cryptic definition. I'm going to try and break it down for you, okay? Where he says this. He says, he's defining a conditional epistemic probability. After the symbols that he puts in place of some conditional propositional statements, okay? And we'll go through propositional logic later, so this kind of thing will become more intelligible to you. So he puts B and then bracket A, and then that figure there, and then B, and then close bracket equals, and then you can see that this is the smallest interval which contains all the intervals which represent the degree to which a rational human being, S, for whom believed B, had no undercutting defeater for A, had no other source of warrant either for A and or not A, this should be not A, yeah, was aware that she believed B and considered the evidence bearing of B on A. Now, this is, in layman's terms, is saying, let's imagine the counterfactual possibility here. So imagine that you have a universe that was not designed, And let's see the probability of that being the case. This kind of probability allows that. But what we're saying is that counterfactual reality itself is an absurd one. You can try and... the thing is, the moment you try and imagine that, what I'm saying is, you're falling into an absurdity. You're falling into an impossibility. And I'll explain why, yeah? The assumption of chance. This assumption that there can be the equivalent of a null hypothesis here, something which you can, a zero, that or some chance that can create, can move around the universe, the constants and the laws of nature, whatever. This assumption is no weight whatsoever. There's no chance. There's no evidence for it. There's no evidence for it. And you're stuck again because how can you get something from nothing? So I don't like this way of making the argument. In addition, you've got another issue with this argument, which is that what if there's some quantum theory that overlaps all of the, or some major theory that bridges the, you know, the quantum world with the physical, with the macro world, and the electromagnetic constant, gravity, all these other things that we talked about, they become less potent as explaining forces, or that those numbers change. And all of this thing is possible with the corrigible and volatile nature of physics. So does that mean that the argument can be made in the same way? No, it wouldn't be made in the same way. Which brings us back to what we spoke about in the previous sessions, which instead of talking about these constants, what I prefer to do, and obviously everyone's free to do their own thing, but is talk about not the things which science discovers, but the things which is required for science to be done. Because it fits the timeless criterion in a better way. So in other words, in order to do science, what do you need? You need a regular system, a stable system, and a predictable system. And the regularity and predictability and stability of the world is established beyond reasonable doubt. And if it's not established, then you wouldn't have science. And just to remind you, the example that we gave is that, you know, you have this phone is not blowing up right now. Why is it not blowing up? Because whatever is keeping it together now has kept it together a second ago and it will keep it together a second from now. Hope it doesn't blow up in my face. You know. But you see the point. So this is the stability and predictability of science. And if we didn't believe in that, and we didn't have that as somewhat of an axiom before even doing science, then we couldn't do science. So instead of using the universal constants and using science, really, physics, to make the argument, you can still make the same argument. You can still say the universe... It's a fact that the universe permits life. It is a fact that the universe permits life. It is a fact that the universe is stable, predictable, uniform. And simply ask, what is the best explanation for this? That's how easy it is. And, you know, because going into probability discussion might be disadvantageous. And you go into a probability discussion, you're putting the null hypothesis chance, zero or whatever it is. But that zero is impossible. We don't even concede to that. So for that reason, I don't like using this argument in this way, unless you use it strictly as a supporting evidence. Strictly, if you use it as supporting evidence, I don't think it's that bad. But using it as a main type of argument, which some people do, What if the people's Martin Rees changes his mind? He writes a book, says six numbers, and then he changes his mind, says actually the electromagnetic thing is this and that. He can change his mind. They can change their mind. They do change their mind. These physicists change their mind within one's own lifetime. So to peg one's hopes on these theories is difficult. And we have to go more fundamental than this, which is why is there something rather than nothing in the first place? Okay? And this goes back. What is the epistemic probability that there may be something rather than nothing? And the epistemic probability, or on an atheistic worldview, is nothing, zero. Is zero. You see the point? What is the epistemic probability that there can be something rather than nothing? Considering an atheistic worldview, there is no possibility of that happening. So we don't need to go into elaborative dice type illustrations. And we talked about the assumption of necessity, and sometimes you can have necessity and it doesn't threaten God thesis. Now, there are some objections to this kind of fine-tuning argument. I've written them down. I mean, you can look at them yourself. But all three of them do not apply to the way that the argument is made. If you simply even don't even make it as an argument, simply ask a question. Why is the universe stable? What explanation do you have? You don't even need to have why. What explanation do you have for the universe permitting life, being stable, being uniform, being regular? I have no explanation. What explanation fits this data best? The fact that the universe is this way. What explanation fits this data best? The less you say, I think the more powerful it is. The more you bring in ideas of probability and epistemic versus Bayesian. Actually, Bayesian is a type of epistemic objective probability. But Bayesian versus total or statistical probability. And you have to now have a mathematical discussion. When they say there's a 20% chance, for example, that, or 50% chance that someone's going to die from cancer, according to cancer research, that is actually the stat. I'm not sure if you know that. 50% of people in the UK die from cancer. Or 50% of people die from cancer. Do you know that? According to the cancer research. 1 in 2. Now, obviously, the majority of them are over the age of 60, yeah? But that's still, that's called a statistical probability. The way they come to that conclusion is basically by seeing how many people die from cancer and divide it and ratio it. But a statistical possibility is not the same, probability is not the same as an epistemic probability and or an inductive, it's referred to as an inductive, or a Bayesian probability. But this is getting, once again, imagine this being a debate or a discussion with some kind of a mathematician, and you now have to define why you're using what probability. You can imagine it even very sticky. So instead of doing all of that, just say, okay, what we can all agree upon is that there's something rather than nothing. These are the agreeables. That we agree that there's something rather than nothing, number one. We agree that the universe is stable, predictable, and uniform. We agree that the universe has a life-permitting range. Now, what explains this data best? Does explaining this data best, if he says chance, if they say chance, if they say that to you, because you're not going to say it's either chance, because it cannot be chance. If they say it's chance, yes, it's chance. You say the burden of proof is upon the one that's making the claim. You're making, what is chance? Explain it, and explain how that can explain the data. Now, they are actually, it's upon them, if they say that, to explain it. It's the burden of proof on them. You don't have to say it can't be chance. Why are you starting? Why are you fighting their battle for them? Let them do it. If they say it's necessity, say, okay, how does necessity threaten the fact that necessity in what sense? So it's all determined, like in a deterministic sense. And then we go back to the idea that if there is an uninterrupted line of causal chains, where does it end? You have an infinite regress. So they're stuck because there is no way of explaining the things that I've just mentioned, the stability, the regularity, the uniformity, the life permitting reality of the universe, and or even that the universe is there in the first place and there's something rather than nothing. You can't, that's it. You explain it. We don't know. You're going to get this answer all the time. We don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Say, what is it reasonable to assume that the laws were put in place by a lawmaker? Which laws are you talking about? The natural laws or the laws of not electromagnetic or this? We're talking about these assumptions, which are the predictability and the uniformity and stability of nature. Those themselves were put in place by an intelligence or a knowledge or something that has knowledge or something that has no knowledge. we know that these patterns exist. Either these patterns exist or were put in place by something that has knowledge or not. So which of the two? And if it's the latter, then explain it, please. Because, and this goes back to what some say is weak, but I don't think it's that weak. Intuitively, we don't act like that. We see something which is, going back to, if you like, the watchmaker thing. We see something with that kind of design, and we assume that something has made it with that has intelligence. That's what we assume all the time. But they have to be counterintuitive in order to come to their conclusions. And I think this is, in many ways, the way that if you look at the Quran, how it makes these kinds of arguments. Sun Allah alladhi atqana kulla shay. That this is the manufacturing of Allah, like the universe, yeah? Or actually, he was talking about the mountains and the earth, and then he says, Sun Allah alladhi atqana kulla shay. The sunnah, the manufacturing of Allah, that he has perfected everything. And when he says, Hal tara min futur, do you see any gaps in creation? So if you look at the way Allah deals with that, it's usually informatively and interrogatively. He doesn't do it in a way that is eliminatively. When it came to the Am khuliqu min ghayri shay'in hum al-khaliqun, that was elimination. But when it came to this, the best way to deal with it is actually ask them questions. Sometimes the best arguments are made, or the best points are made through questions, rather than, so you tell them what it is. You tell them what's happened, what do we have here? We have a universe with regularity, with stability and uniformity, which is life permitting. We have laws, or these patterns of nature. Either they're explained through something that puts laws into place, and intelligence, or it's not. If it's not, can you give us an alternative? If they say multiverse and all these kind of things, it's aside the point. Because the multiverse needs an explanation, just like, as we've said before, just like the universe does. You see, it needs an explanation just like the universe does. And it probably needs more of an explanation. So with that, we conclude. We're going to talk now. I know I've been speaking for a long time, but we're going to try these discussions now. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.